and welcome to the Field Notes podcast from Arosha. I'm Bryony Lovelace and I'm a researcher with Arosha.
And I'm Peter Harris and I've been with Arosha from the beginning when we established a field study centre and bird observatory in the south of Portugal in 1983.
Now, we all know that the rapid thinning of life on Earth and the climate crisis can often feel overwhelming.
So it's our hope that in this podcast you'll hear some remarkable and original perspectives from people we know who are working to care for creation around the world.
I often think, you know, Jesus says, you know, love your neighbour as yourself. I'm not too keen personally on having my home drowned. You know, that's what our coal and our lifestyle is doing to our neighbours in the Pacific. The rising seas are taking away their homes. How can we not be angry about that? But we've got to love the people who make us angry as well.
Welcome back, faithful listeners, to the Arosha Field Notes podcast. And this time we had the great privilege of talking with Stuart Blanche from Arosha in Australia. And it was a particularly moving interview, I thought. I don't know how you felt about it, Bryony.
Yeah, it was very moving. He spoke a lot about the toll that environmental campaigning and conservation has on mental health, and his honesty about the emotional impact of this kind of work was really powerful. And his accent was also just really delightful to listen to. There was a part where he talked about his father being a banana farmer. And I think after the interview, I was going around saying like, banana, but I can't do it. I'm going on a tangent.
There's worse that lies ahead of us in the future, I think. But it's true that I've had a long time to get used to it because, in fact, Stuart was one of those who was involved right at the beginning of Arosha in Australia in 2005. So he's hung in there for a long time. And he is a remarkable person. Not only is he a highly qualified ecologist, and he's been involved in his work with WWF, for whom he works now, in some high-profile campaigns. But he's also got a postgrad degree in environmental law. So he knows all sides of it. He knows it from an academic perspective, but he particularly has really had his boots on the ground for a long time.
He put me on the spot halfway through the interview when he asked me, why do you think you shouldn't be angry? And he talks a lot in the interview about being angry. And later on in the interview, he says that I don't feel bad about being angry. I feel bad about being angry poorly or not being angry enough. And that was a real challenge to me. And I think it really put me on the spot about being angry and how we use our anger about, you know, the destruction of a lot of God's creation or the rising global average temperature. And he talks about, you know, how can we be angry and be peacemakers? I don't know if you have any thoughts on that, Peter. It's a really...
Yes, it's really struck me because there is that strand of anger through the Psalms, which, as you know, I read a lot and often. And in some of the lament in scripture, there's a strand of anger. And it's interesting to reflect for a science-based organization like ourselves, how to be angry based on good science and how to keep all of that within our conversation with God. I think, again, Ellen Davis, who we interviewed earlier, talks about how as long as it's within the conversation with God, then it's something that can be fruitful. And like you, I was very challenged by Stuart's absolute blazing honesty on all things apart from cricket.
I think he also, you know, touches on eco-anxiety and how it's become, well, it is becoming more widely recognized. And it's really important that we face that and we destigmatize the truth of how hard this crisis is, particularly for people working on the front lines. And it is really powerful to hear this, you know, I've never met Stuart, but I imagine he's a broad Australian man who's, you know, worked and really fought in this area for a really long time, to be so honest about how much this has impacted him and how distressing he finds it.
Yes, and I think that long experience is why I listen hard to people like him. This isn't something he discovered on the back page of a newspaper, gosh, we're in trouble. This is something that he has been working with and had very deep personal relationships in some of the communities affected, as he talks to us about Arnhem Land and all of that.
That's why he's really lived it, hasn't he?
Yeah.
Again, we speak in this interview, as we did with in a previous episode with Paul Correa, about First Nations people. Do you want to define that again for those of you who maybe haven't listened to the interview with Paul?
Yes, I think essentially he's referring there to the people who originally had this land and who lived and worked this land, the First Nations. And that's just one of the terms that gets used.
Yeah. Before we begin, we should just warn our listeners that during the interview, he tells a story about his experience of campaigning in Arnhem Land. And just as a warning, part of that, he tells us a story of a girl who very sadly took her own life whilst being part of a campaign to conserve some of the land there. And we do talk a lot about mental health, Anika, and anxiety, and I hope that you'll find it as useful as I did speaking to Stuart. And we do end by speaking about hope and how we can sustain campaigning for the long haul, because Stuart really has seen all kinds of things over his career, and it was a real pleasure to talk to him. So we hope you enjoy. Stuart, thank you so much for joining us this morning / this evening. You've given your life to nature conservation, and I was wondering if you could tell us about how that started.
Thank you. G'day from Australia. And I grew up in the 1970s before the global environmental juggernaut really kicked off. And I was just in it because I was having fun. You know, I grew up on the beach, in the bush, swimming and fishing and snorkeling and doing all that sort of stuff you did as a kid. And my wife often calls it the Huckleberry Finn experience, which I loved. And I look back and I realize it was not normal for a lot of people. And I didn't grow up in the city. And I think I was deeply exposed to nature all around me, the birds in the morning, fishing, you know, seeing big goannas and snakes in the backyard, and occasionally you just thought, well, that's how everybody grows up. And my dad was a banana farmer, so I'd have to spend a fair bit of time with him and my siblings and my mum doing that, helping out on weekends or holidays. So, yeah, I loved it, and I got under my skin. And my first career goal, I think I was 11, was to be a marine biologist. And I spent, because I thought it would pay you to spearfish your whole life. Alas, that turns out not to be true. I also have First Nations hereditary through my mum's line. And I loved the thought of being a young Aboriginal fellow out there spearing fish, not going to school. So part of it was escapism, Brian. I'll be very honest about that. But I loved it, you know, and it made me feel at peace and alive. And I think that's been with me ever since, even though I never got to become a marine biologist.
Well, when I was 11, I think my career aspirations were not as glorious as that. I think I just wanted to be, I don't know, like a horse groom or something. So that's much more impressive. Can you tell us
Did you get to become a horse groom?
No, spoiler alert, they don't pay very well, and you can't spend all your days with horses.
we both lucked out then on our career aspirations. Okay.
Indeed. So tell us about your career since leaving school. How did you kind of become more involved in conservation, and what do you do now?
Well, I never thought I'd ever be a conservationist, let alone an environmental advocate, let alone for, you know, a national or international environment organisation. I was a shy, introvert, awkward, really not interested in big city, not interested in girls, not interested in money, was really a bit slow. In fact, my Sunday school teacher and primary school teacher, she told my mum once when I was in end of primary school, if Stuart doesn't actually start learning and applying himself, he'll be a lollipop man, you know, on the council, the guy who does the stop-go signs. I was not a shining beacon. So how I got there, from there to being a, you know, getting a PhD and all that, I still don't know. I think it's because I couldn't get a proper job and I wanted to be a biologist. I wanted to be a scientist. And I was following in the path of my brother, my older brother, who's a professor in chemistry. And that's what I wanted to do. And that's what I thought my career path would be. So that's what I was doing. And I switched from an interest in marine ecology because, to be honest, I get terribly seasick. And I thought that's never going to work to be, being a limnologist, a freshwater ecologist. And that's what I trained in.
And so tell us about the road into Arosha a little bit as well then, because it's been quite the journey, hasn't it? I mean, we first started talking, Stuart, I guess it must have been, I don't know, 20 years ago perhaps, or 15.
It's, I think, 2001, I think, was our first
there you go,
call. And I think I contacted Chris Naylor in 1998.
Okay.
I gave my life to the Lord Jesus when I was 12, grew up in a not a family that's a church-going family, but, you know, Christian hereditary, I guess. And he was the first love of my life and remains so. I didn't really see my interest in nature or wanting to be a, go to university and be a scientist as really that relevant. I just thought it was in a parallel track that sort of, you know, bumped along occasionally when people took exception to scientists. And, you know, you've got to choose, Stuart, science or following the Lord. And I could never get that, and I still can't. I switched from being interested in science as a biologist to being a conservationist at heart when I saw the things that I loved being destroyed in a matter of years. The creek that I grew up on was called Swimming Creek. No one swims in it now. I swam in it in the 70s and 80s. It was my whole life. And now it's polluted, dirty, you know, it's just still breaks my heart. That changed me in my late teenage years. I started to think I've got to do something about protecting these things. Otherwise, they'll continue to disappear. I still didn't see it as a matter of living out my faith as a follower of Jesus. I just saw it as something that's also deeply rooted in my life. It was when I think I was doing my doctoral research, a PhD on the River Murray, our big river basin in southeastern Australia used for our food bowl irrigation, that I thought more and more about applying freshwater ecology to management and conservation. And it wasn't long after my PhD that I got offered a job, a very poorly paid job in a small conservation group doing river conservation in the Murray-Darling Basin. And I thought, I'll take this job for 6 months until I can get a postdoc being a river scientist, then I'll switch back. After about a month, I thought, there's no way I'm going back to being a scientist. It was too much fun speaking truth to power, applying the science that I'd learned and read and from all the people I respected to management. I just thought, this is the life for me. And it was probably a decade of doing that sort of work that increasingly I thought, I don't see, and I've been married, no kids at that time, but how does this relate to my life as a disciple of Jesus Christ? How do I apply this? There weren't lots of people in the fairly conservative evangelical churches I was grew up in and was part of who talked about this, who wanted to talk about it. I tended to keep some of those thoughts to myself, I guess. So it was really, ironically, in a very conservative evangelical Anglican church in Sydney, which I can tell you there weren't too many sermons about creation care, that there was this little article in our weekend magazine, our newsletter, about a freshwater ecologist needed to be a missionary in Lebanon working for this group called Arocha, which I couldn't even pronounce. So that's when that happened in 1998, and that's when I found out about Arocha.
I read an article you wrote, I think back in December, for the Man and Matters magazine, which I found very moving. And you wrote in it, "The environment and my faith were on parallel tracks, rarely intersecting and occasionally colliding," which I thought was a really amazing statement. And, well, amazing and one to grieve, I guess. I'd love to hear more about your experience of the church and what you might say to people who are also struggling with this disconnect between how they feel about the climate and the climate crisis and what they're witnessing and experiencing in their churches.
Yeah. For me, and this has been a long journey, but to me, it is resolved down to, as a person, I want to find out what the truth is, wherever that goes. And science teaches me a lot about truth, but it cannot answer all questions. And my faith in the scriptures and a relationship with God teaches me about truth. It doesn't answer all the how-to stuff of science. And so I now no longer struggle with bringing those together because I'm involved in Arosha. And I see increasingly all of the environmental and conservation science things that I've been involved in for 30 years and doing through a science lens and a theological lens. And it's not always easy, you know, wearing the hat of a Christian, a biologist, and an environmental advocate.
Can I press you about where the pinch points come, Stuart, for you, or where they have come? Because, you know, you've I know, because we're old friends, that you've had some really tough times in that advocacy as well, and we'll talk about that perhaps in a while. Mm. But where have been the kind of the presenting issues for you in living, if you like, in or putting on both of those lenses every morning as you go out the door?
Yeah,
early in the morning, being a conservation person.
Although I trained as a botanist, I wasn't as crazy as you bird watchers and ornithologists. I don't have to get up so early. My subject matter never moved around so much, Peter. So I was wiser than you were. It is, you know, I work in the mainstream secular conservation movement, and there are not many believers in that space. And for a long time, I was judicious in who I shared with my faith and why I believed, why I read the Bible, why I prayed, why I went to church. And so I think that was hard for me for a long time. And I was at times ridiculed, and that was hard. And it wasn't very popular, and I was blamed as a representative of believers who, for many people, Christianity has caused many of our world problems. And that's, I now, you know, I've got a way with dealing with that. As a Christian, well, to be honest, a lot of it was reading in Arosha resources and others about the passages in the scriptures that helped me understand how God sees his creation. It's not ours. It's not mine. And as I, particularly as I understood more of the, say, the modern Greek, about how to interpret some of those passages in the New Testament that some people have and still do use to justify an argument, well, we don't have to care about the environment because it's all about saving souls. The world will be judged. There will be none left. We'll all go to heaven, and we don't have to worry about any of that. And, you know, as I understood more about how, including, you know, different translations of the Bible have taken different words to be slightly different, you know, a new earth versus a renewed earth, really important. And I found that very hard to reconcile, Peter. And I guess I have tried to find people who are, you know, well-trained, thoughtful, prayerful Bible scholars and teachers to understand how to resolve these issues. And so now I used to feel like on Sunday I'll hop into my Christian sort of life on the Sunday, and then Monday through to Friday, except for Wednesday nights, I'll be in the biologist and Christian, you know, conservation area. Now I have a foot in both camp 7 days a week. Sometimes I hop from foot to foot a bit. It's a bit awkward, but maybe that's the benefit of having teenage kids who tell you their whole life everything I do is wrong, or I should do better, or being 51. And I sort of, to be honest, I've had to develop a very thick skin, you know, and including I ran for parliament once. You work out who your friends are when that happens. And I realized I don't care so much anymore what people think. You know, I just don't care. Mm. It's not that I'm uncaring. It's just I can never satisfy everybody. I can't.
I feel, as you're speaking, I was just thinking about sort of I'm very much different generation to the two of you. And
You can edit that bit out.
I get quite angry because I feel as though the church has let down my generation in the sense that there hasn't been enough teaching about creation. And maybe that's also your experience from what you've said.
Yeah. There still isn't, I don't think. And it's, well, I would say, why do you feel like, Bryony, that you need to not be angry? You know, how can you not be angry?
That's probably
and
a
anxious.
Question.
The Apostle Paul was anxious. He suffered anxiety. Mm. If you read his readings, look what Jesus did in the clearing of the temple, his anger about sin and hypocrisy, you know, anger about people not loving their neighbors or the poor, the widows. I mean, that drives me. I think the challenge I find is how to be angry in a righteous way and be a peacemaker. You know, blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called sons of God. And I think the hardest times in my life as a believer who is in the middle of, you know, this ongoing biodiversity and climate crisis, the catastrophe we're all living through and getting worse largely, is when I am with other believers who also firmly believe in the Lord God and whose lives have been changed. They're believers just like me. And they have a very different view, or perhaps no view, about the role of creation care. And they do not see the Bible directing them to be good stewards or tempering money-making or destruction. And I find that so hard. I mean, that is the times in my life when I've felt most gutted. I don't mind people attacking me, and it's in my job to be as an environmental advocate. That's part of the rough and tumble. For me, it is how to be angry based on good science as a believer and looking forward to my kids, if they have kids, and their kids and their kids and their kids, and the people around the world who are affected by what I do and what Australians do, given our global climate, our global supply chains, our global finance system. We can impact people everywhere in the world without ever traveling, and particularly a wealthy country like mine. So I try to be angry in a way that I think I can see how Jesus lived that and the godly people in the Testaments, old and new, and to love at the same time the people who make me angry and to pray for them. Mm-hmm. You know, that's when that drives me to my knees, praying for the people I've been criticizing during the day, that I feel like I'm on that. I'm trying to carry my cross in my job.
Mm. I think it would be moving for people to hear about a particular time when you were involved in an angry campaign, if you like, which was the one in Arnhem Land. And would you mind telling us a little bit about that? Because I think that was a very, almost a defining moment for you in your advocacy work. One of them, yeah.
Well, for those of the listeners who don't know where Arnhem Land is, it's a part in northern Australia in the tropics, very close to Indonesia and Papua New Guinea, East Timor. It's predominantly Aboriginal land, First Nations. People have lived there, you know, 65,000 years, a very, very long time based on the archaeological dating. About half of the Northern Territory where I used to live is freehold Aboriginal land. It's never been, you know, taken off the Aboriginal people. And I always thought my job was to try to protect the non-Aboriginal sort of part, or at least from a white fella point of view, the land where the rivers were being dammed and the land clearing and deforestation was happening, the pollution was happening, because the rest was protected. And increasingly I realised that was not the case, because the Aboriginal land was being targeted by the oil and gas industry for oil exploration and production in the in the estuaries and the shallow seas just off the coast where the land rights law did not apply. It did not give Aboriginal people the veto over development. So traditional owners who did not read the paper, did not read the advertisements and the notices from the government about so-and-so company had been approved to pour all over your land, you could not prevent it. And in the end, they might end up developing an oil resource or gas resource just off your land in your, you know, their ancestral waters where they fished and hunted. Anyway, we were contacted by traditional owners and the non-Aboriginal people working with them saying, help us. This is, you know, how is this happening? Help us to run a campaign to stop it. And, you know, for people who've worked and lived in Indigenous communities, whether in majority or minority world countries, it's a hard life. It's not easy. And often not the capacity or money to deal with these big, powerful companies and their lawyers and accountants who know how to get around the law. Anyway, so we supported quite a few people. I'd fly out there and travel and take traditional owners down to Sydney or Canberra to lobby and get national or global media coverage. And some of them had never traveled outside the territory, let alone, you know, down to the big metropolises in the south of Australia. And there was one lady, it was a man and a lady, an elderly man who's very strong. He was a lawman, owned land. He was, I guess you might say, a chief, but bigger than a chief for his people. And then there was a young lady who was passionate, you know, passionate about protecting her land. She was a teacher and she wanted to inspire the young generation to grow up and protect their country, to fight for the land, to protect Arnhem Land. And, you know, they won. The oil company wouldn't come to Arnhem Land. They didn't have to. The law didn't require them. So we found the money and we took the traditional owners down to Sydney and Canberra to confront them and the politicians. And we knocked on their door in the middle of the financial center of Sydney, said, we're here to talk. You can't come into our country without talking to us. And it was like, I mean, I love accountants. They were very mild-mannered accountants, not quite accustomed to having fierce, angry First Nations people in their face saying, get off our country. You have not sought consent. And they left. And they won. The traditional owners won. And it was one, for me, a highlight of my life working there, that we shouldn't have had to do it. The law should have protected their country, but we could help them. It's their victory. It wasn't mine. I could work out how to help them speak and speak truth to power. And, you know, the media love passionate Indigenous people fighting for the land. And so it was, you know, it was very hard when that young lady took her life afterwards, when they'd won, because of the pressure. And she had a lot of expectations on her, a lot of expectations as a leader. And she suffered from mental illness, and I'm familiar with that in my family, so I understand partly how that can be. And people needed her to stand up for a community, and she did. And the price she paid was very hard. And I don't think those lovely, mild-mannered accountants ever realised, or the bureaucrats who allowed that to happen, or the legislators who wrote the law that allowed that to happen, sees the personal toll that that took just on that community for that one battle. And those First Nations communities, even in their own land like that, are fighting these sorts of battles across lots of different issues, not just environmental, year in, year out. So, you know, I try to work out how to, as a scientist and conservation advocate and as a Christian, how to deal with all that. And, you know, it's one of the, as you said, Peter, defining moment for me that I got to leave. I moved back down to southern Australia for work and family reasons. They don't. They're tied to country. They can't move. Not for long. The culture ties into country. And they now have one less strong fighter. And I think that's deeply tragic.
As you were speaking, it just made me think about the human cost. You know, sometimes there's a very real human cost, but quite often there's a just an emotional burden that a lot of us carry, a lot of eco-anxiety, which you've kind of just touched on.
Well, I didn't have to bear that. You know, the cost I bear is small, but it did cost. But I think the hardest time for me in terms of dealing with that anxiety, and, you know, it's called eco-anxiety, it's broader than that for me, is last year after our catastrophic bushfires in Australia, you know, 19 million hectares burnt. Mm. We've never had that. And it was like mega fires burning for months. And those fires are not far from me. And we could see them. We could smell them. We were all covered in the dust and the smoke, and the animals were all invading our backyard because they were trying to find bush. And I remember I sort of choked up and partly broke down on, I think it was a live South African TV breakfast show, when I had to keep repeating the scale of the loss and the amount, number of animals killed or displaced, and the carbon emissions, and the number of trees, billions burnt, and animals, billions burnt. I sort of broke down.
I wanted to ask you about that, because as you said, the scale is enormous. Something like 2.46 billion reptiles died in those fires. Like, it's just, you can't even get your head around those figures.
Died or lost their habitat, or were, if they could run away quickly enough, they might have survived. But yeah, it's billions. And I worked in my day job with quite a few of those scientists to try to help them. How do you estimate this? It's very difficult. You don't often have the data density or the taxa density data that you need to do that modeling at a continental scale.
I was just going to say, I think in the UK, sort of, I was aware that there was this, I was aware that it was going on. I saw the footage of like koalas running away from the fires, and, you know, there's quite a lot of distressing imagery. It's really interesting to hear you talk about your personal experience of it, because it, you know, it's very easy to forget that this does actually happen to real people.
I had to see a counsellor. I'd never seen a counsellor. As a scientist, you're not trained to deal with emotion. It is driven out of you. Maybe it's not these days in undergrad, but as a biologist, it's about facts and observations, writing in the third person, dispassionately. I remember when I started working the environment movement, a lot of my former science colleagues would, you know, castigate me for being too emotional. I found that really hard. So I was offered at work, you know, regularly, do you want to go and see the employment assistance program, the careers, the counselors? And I said, no, it'll be right. It'll be okay. As a Christian, I didn't think I should need it. I think that was part of it. I take it to the Lord in prayer and in meditation on the Word of God. And, I broke down. Couldn't talk. Was giving nasty media interviews. My bosses benched me, which I hated. And then I realized I had to talk. And not to someone who understood it from a conservation point of view. Went and saw a professional counsellor, and I thank God that she was a strong Christian. And I spent an hour unloading all of my fear, that everything I've been working for 20, 30 years, and notwithstanding all the, you know, as you say, victories, or the things you'd improved, the things that had gotten better, more national parks, stronger laws, more money, putting rewilding wildlife that had long been disappeared, getting rid of feral animals, that would all be overwhelmed by the impacts of global heating. And so I relayed this to her, and there was a lot of tears. And I think she'd never had an environmental campaigner sit on a couch. And I, you know, talked about our faith and how to address this as believers. And after an hour, I was exhausted. I think she was exhausted. And I'd gone to a box of tissues, and I said, right, well, I guess that's done. I guess I don't need to come back. He said, oh, no, you're coming back.
That's the beginning.
I'm booking a lot of meetings for you. So at that time I thought, oh, okay, this is worse than I thought, actually. It's probably explaining why I'm breaking down on live TV in South Africa.
There really are huge strains, I think, in leadership, and not least in leadership of Arusha. And partly that's because we have got into some quite serious campaigns around the world, quite apart from the emotional toll of witnessing this sort of destruction on that kind of scale. And there's a number of Arusha teams that are fighting those kind of battles. There's the Atewa work that's going on in Ghana. And obviously we've been stuck into the Alvor estuary. You know, it's been a 35-year crisis. Sort of. So I wonder, based on some of the things you've learned and you've seen, what would be your advice for how to keep campaigning for the long haul, and how to find that anger that you talked about earlier, something as creative? Or what are your thoughts about that?
Well, I look to the Old Testament prophets, Amos, Habakkuk, Jeremiah, Isaiah, thinking about justice. That's what I think about. How do you bring justice? And it's not the only thing I think about, but when I think about should, for example, Arusha in Australia be more involved in advocacy, it worries me, because I think in my life as a environmental advocate, it's very easy to just be a bit of a whinging voice. And I've done it. You know, there's lots of things I regret in my life. And if you don't speak from good science and knowledge, and representing people in the community, a large supporter base, or large, more deep and broad networks into, you know, your society, you know, you might get some column inches and on the radio and the TV, or these days lots of social media posts, but I don't think it's that effective. And so for Arusha in Australia and globally, I think advocacy has a real role, but advocacy without a strong basis of doing science, conservation science, doing research, publishing papers, being in a place for years, decades, where people get to know you in the good and the bad times, and how you do science. It's not easy. A lot of it's very hard, and it's slow. You know, it takes a long time to build that. So I would say you don't go first to advocacy and say, we'll get to the conservation science and the living as a believer in a society in the years or decades ahead. So I think the sequencing is important. But I think if Arusha and other Christian environmental groups do not speak truth to power, do not try to bring justice to the poor, the widows, the orphans, as those Old Testament prophets talked about and as Jesus talked about in the New Testament, we are not fully living out our lives as believers in the space of creation care. I think a lot of it is about how do you earn and develop trust and credibility so that people don't just see you as a litigant, but as an agent to bring godliness and justice and pointing to God in how you, for example, write a press release, give a media interview, go and lobby a politician, or litigate through the court system. I think it's very hard for small NGOs like, you know, Arusha Australia. We're tiny. We can't do it all. But in the future, you know, I don't think we should take that option away. Neither should we be thought of as, oh, they're the Christian environmental litigants, or they're only the advocates. that's if we did that, I think we'd fail, because that's not the model of Arosha that drew me to it, and I love it. I think my thought is, you know, when Arosha started in the 80s, some of these things that we deal now with now, the plastic pollution issue, ocean acidification, the global heating catastrophe, they were not known much, or they were poorly known, or not felt. Now they are. And I think the model of Arosha needs to be able to respond to that at a broader scale now. My fear is though it just wears us out, because we can't do it all well on shoestring budgets and volunteers wearing ourselves out. I don't know. I pray a lot about that. And our directors in Arosha Australia think a lot about how do we do all this? Yes, it concerns us deeply.
Mm. Part of my struggle with trying to understand eco-anxiety and, you know, these very real angry emotions that we have, and how to do that with our faith, you know, trying to hold those two things together is really hard, because it doesn't always feel, you know, people are saying take them to God in prayer, and sometimes I think, well, sometimes it doesn't feel like prayer's enough, you know.
Well, I just, you know, remember the Lord Jesus in prayer so much, he still got angry, and righteously so. You know, he confronted the people who should have done better, who should have known better, who had ignored the Old Testament, had made up their own rules. You know, it was like, I don't feel bad about being angry. I feel bad when I'm angry poorly, and I feel angry when I'm not angry enough, because, you know, we're here in Australia where we've got the, I think, highest or second highest carbon pollution per person in the world. I live in the city, which is, I think, the largest coal port in Southern Hemisphere, or maybe globally. I'm from a family line of people who logged rainforest, shot endangered animals, destroyed our rivers. The list goes on. So I'm very aware of where I've come from. You know, I'm... it is very personal for me, and I think, how do I, you know, that great Old Testament view of you need to repay back when you have stolen. If you have done something to harm your neighbor unfairly, I'm held accountable, even though I've said sorry. You know, I will not be responsible for what my parents' generation and they did before that and before that. But particularly for First Nations, they're still going through the trauma of that, and the impact we have in Australia now extends to our neighbours. I often think, you know, Jesus says, you know, love your neighbour as yourself. I'm not too keen personally on having my home drowned. You know, that's what our coal and our lifestyle is doing to our neighbours in the Pacific, many of whom are very godly believers. I pray for them. We send our church sends missionaries to them every year, support them, whilst their homes increasingly battered by Category 3 cyclones, Category 4 cyclones, Category 5 cyclones.
Thankfully, I guess not many of us have to face those kind of extreme weather events, at least not as regularly as you seem to. But nevertheless, we are characterizing ourselves in Arosha for each other and for ourselves as a hopeful organization, because there's a lot of reasons for people who care about any of this to get badly hurt and damaged and to end up not just on the counsellor's couch, but worse. And so I wanted to ask you in your specific context what you see as hopeful, because I think hope is local, isn't it, sometimes? And hope is particular. It's not just, you know, I can certainly feel in the days when I used to take caffeine, I could feel more hopeful after a good strong coffee. But so where do you see the signs of hope in Australia at the moment for you and for Arosha and for people you know in environmental organisations?
There are many great things happening in the Australian environment and climate movements, and I'm part of that. And sometimes you don't see it until you step back or someone says, oh, that's a very good outcome. You know, Australia has, I think, the highest rate of rooftop solar uptake in the world. You know, notwithstanding our crazy climate politics down here in Australia, people and businesses are getting, and banks are getting on with it ahead of the politicians. I love that. You know, increasingly, farmers, landowners, councils are revegetating vast areas, millions and millions of hectares of the bush, which were cleared, you know, 50, 100, 200 years ago. We're putting the nature back. People, after our terrible bushfires, people open up their wallets to donate to organizations trying to, like, save forests, save koalas, help to bring back nature after the terrible droughts and the fires, then the floods. And we're back to fires again this week, you know, in terms of burning off. So if there's an upside of the terrible impacts, is that you can see them now, even smack in the middle of Sydney, you can't escape those, the cataclysms anymore. They come right into people's living rooms, literally the smoke. That gives me great hope. I love being involved in projects like rewilding, particularly Australia's amazing marsupials. You know, they really, most of them don't occur anywhere else in the world. We have a responsibility to look after them. We've got the world's worst record in mammal extinctions. And I work with people and landowners. I've got friends in other organizations. They're putting their animals back in the wild, often behind predator-proof fence, but in one day, they'll be out back in the wild. I love that. You know, it's something that's practical. You can see it. Anybody can do it. A lot of it's not PhD science level. It's a lot of it's just good common sense working with landowners and trying to understand the animals. I really love that. I mean, I was partly involved, but many people have done much more in creating new national parks and marine parks. I think that's wonderful. When things no longer become an issue of the left versus right of politics in terms of environmental policy, I think we've largely won, just as a matter of then law and, you know, money really to implement good policy. I love the fact now that when you go to your local hardware store, there's more and more local native plants for sale and less from other parts of the world. Why? Because it makes businesses money because people want to grow them. More wildlife comes back. Going on to me personally, how to maintain hope. Well, it is that there is a God who made us in our image. He reveals himself to us in creation, and through his intervening, the creation of his people all those years ago, Abram, Isaac and Jacob, people of Israel, the kings, the prophets, pointing towards Jesus. Nothing can take away from me the fact that he went to the cross. That gives me hope. And when I'm in prayer on my knees, imagining, knowing that I'm included in the people when Jesus said to disciples, go forth into all the world and make disciples of all nations. I benefited from that. So nothing takes that away from me. Sometimes I have to strain hard to remember it and stop reading the news and stop looking at social feeds. The death and resurrection of Jesus Christ, nothing takes that away.
Thanks for listening to the Field Notes podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review and subscribe.
And there's more information about this podcast and about Arosha at arosha.org. So do join us next time.